is a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaVerge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So whatever the headline, whatever the debate, from foreign affairs to affairs of the heart, from politics to parenting, God has something to say about all of it. But too often, his people are standing on the sidelines of those discussions, and we hope to change that. We want to help you get God back into every conversation by challenging you to think about what you're thinking about, and then to challenge you to think about how you are thinking about that, to get God's perspective on the news of the day in order that you can be an ambassador of that perspective to others. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. Let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge, hashtag Carmen Talk. We also always want to hear from you right here in the studio. You can call or text at 877-655-6755. Friends, I've got a stellar guest for you today, a well-known theologian, leader, and author, to talk with us about how Christians can live out their faith in our pluralistic and politically charged culture. His name is Miroslav Volf. He is the Henry B. Wright Professor of Systematic Theology at Yale. He's also the founding director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. He has served as an advisor for the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. He's a frequent commentator. He's written more than 15 books and dozens of scholarly articles. His 1996 book, Exclusion and Embrace, was named by Christianity Today as one of the 100 most influential books of the 20th century, and I would argue that his newest book, which is Public Faith in Action, How to Think Carefully, Engage Wisely, and Vote with Integrity, is equally as good. So, Miroslav Volf, welcome to The Reconnect.
Oh, it's great to be on your show.
So, okay, at the very most basic level, let's start with what it means for citizens of a representative republic to steward their influence in public life.
Well, I think we have simply a responsibility. I think our faith gives us a responsibility to care not just for our private lives, family lives, or church lives, but to care for our common life being God's creation, and therefore ought to be aligned in the appropriate ways to the purposes of God with creation. So we have a public responsibility.
Absolutely. And so this book is really what I would consider like an ethics primer. And so you will appreciate the conversation that I had in the car this morning on the way to school with a 13-year-old who, after we listened to some things that other people may not be listening to, podcasts and things like that, on the way to school. And at the end of listening to one of them, she turned to me and she said, "Okay, so what exactly does ethics mean?" And I thought to myself, well, there you go. Now we've been listening to something, and now I'm going to have to translate for her a word that I kind of assume people know what it means. So as a professor here, how did I do? I sort of fumbled around with a combination of, it's the way we think about right and wrong. I referred to a moral compass, our conscience, the way that our life is guided from the inside out. But what should I have said? Let's define the concept of ethics, not just personally, but collectively for we the people.
Well, I think what you said was exactly right. What I would simply just add, almost like a footnote, but an important one, would be that that ethics helps us to find good ways of deliberating about what we should do. End result is our commitments are clarified and we know what we ought to do. It simply tells us what ought to be done and helps us to find out what we ought to do. Because that's not completely clear. You know, there are very many situations in which we know exactly how we ought to act. But there are many situations, especially in our complicated world, and in the world that has become very different also from the world in which the sources of our moral thinking, namely the Bible and Jesus Christ, have lived and have been written. It's very different to that world, and then we need to find ways in which to connect that which gives us moral obligation to the situations, many different situations in which we find ourselves.
Okay, you used some phrases in there that I think I'm going to pull out and invite you to talk more about. One of them is this concept of a good means of deliberation. I think that oftentimes we simply just defend whatever position we think we should be holding, whatever it is, based on, as you say, a source that may or may not be just immediately applicable in the current situation and scenario. But because we know that that is what that source says, we'll bring it up and we'll refer to it and we will keep referring to it. And we're defending it. We're really not engaged in this good deliberation. So talk with us about how we engage in this good deliberation with one another amidst these very, very complex conversations we're having today in our culture.
Well, sometimes what we do, we pull out our favorite verse, and we think that that favorite verse from the Bible defines the entirety of our obligation in particular situation. And then when the way to deliberate about this, about it might be, well, what other verses might bear upon the situation, how they might inform and influence what we are stating. And then, I think also very importantly, how is that which we are asked to do, in particular maybe verses and situation, related to the entirety of the life of Christ? Jesus Christ, for us as Christians, is the incarnation of God, is God incarnate, and as God incarnate, he stands for what we ought to be doing. He is the key to our humanity, and therefore everything that we do and think ought to be aligned with the life of Jesus Christ. Now, how that alignment ought to take place, that often is a question that we need to ask. For instance, we live in what is described as liberal democracy. And Jesus lived under occupation of Roman power in a very small corner of the world with very little power itself. Israel at that time was occupied. Now, what Jesus instructed folks in that situation might not exactly translate one-to-one with what Jesus might want us in a very different situation to do. And then, also, there are such things as very novel kinds of questions. For instance, everything that concerns how we use modern media, everything that much of what concerns how we apply modern medicine, might not be directly derivable from the Bible and from the life of Jesus. So we have to think carefully about it.
We have to think carefully about it, and then we have to find those biblical principles that even though the answer might not be specifically derived from a particular verse, the principle is easily derived from what Scripture as a whole has to say. Would that be accurate? Okay, good.
Yes,
all right, friend, let me remind our friends that are listening that they're listening to The Reconnect, that we are talking with Professor Miroslav Volf. He is a global theologian. Now that some water is under the bridge related to this election cycle, if you had known when you were writing the book, if you had known then what you know now about this election cycle, is there anything you would have added to the book that isn't in there now? Or maybe something you would have approached differently? Just curious.
You know, I'm not sure. And one of the obviously, one could always address a kind of a particular election. One of the things that we decided, my co-author and I, when we were writing this book, is not to make this a book about a single election, but to make it a book about how we should school our judgment and our thinking so that we can assess not only elections for highest office, but at varieties of levels, how we can assess local governments from towns to states to national scene. I think what in the book I find important in this present also debate is one, we have a strong emphasis on character. Character both of the person, of the electorate, who is making judgments about candidates, but also character of the candidates themselves. What we try to also do is to lay basic foundational work that would then, even in new situations that come up, would be of help. One of the things, for instance, that I would have loved that we had time to include in the book is something about privacy. Why privacy matters, how we should treat privacy, and what light does biblical faith shed on the issues of privacy.
And I would suppose that in our current context, how much privacy am I as an individual willing to yield in terms of security, in terms of the guarantee or a higher sense of being secure?
Right. And exactly. What do I... What do we, and each of us in particular, gain from having the sphere of privacy? What do we lose when we give up the privacy? To whom can privacy be lost and why? All these questions, I think, are very important, and it's important for us not to think of them simply in as related to a particular issue that we are facing. Obviously, big issue for us is now terrorism, and we worry about how do we prevent future attacks. But there is a kind of larger issue of what privacy means, not simply for our security at this moment, but what it means for our ability to mature, for instance, as individuals. You know, I was talking to my wife about this, and she's a writer, and we were talking about privacy, and she said, well, you know, I would like to have people see the drafts of my writing. People not seeing me having a private space is my possibility to grow into something that I want to be for myself and also in public. And I think that's a very important aspect of our privacy, ability to grow in private so that we become those who we want to become.
Well, and the whole notion of growing up in every way into Christ, who is the head, there are many aspects of my life where my growth, I mean, I think my growth is always uneven across different parts of my spiritual maturity and my development. And so I understand her concern that folks might see into a part of me that is still in need of serious maturation, right? There points of my own personal life where I am not quite as mature as maybe I am in other areas of my life. Hey, friends, you're listening to The Reconnect. We are privileged to be talking with Professor Miroslav Volf. He is the co-author of Public Faith in Action, which is an opportunity for you to engage in thinking about what you're thinking about and thinking about how you're thinking about that in terms not only of your personal ethics, but the ethics that we engage in our conversations in the public square and about public things. And so in particular, I thought that the chapter on euthanasia was very, very powerful. And I think that one of the areas that Christians lag behind the culture is when we're talking about advancements in technology and particularly in advancements related to technology and medicine. And so I'm wondering if there is a way to help people understand what the principles are that Christians need to adopt and use when we are in conversations and considerations about life and death.
I think we have organized this chapter around the idea, kind of twofold idea, that on the one hand, life is sacred. Life is sacred from the beginning to its end, and it is in God's hand. But on the other hand, life is not the highest good. Right? If life were the highest good, Jesus would not have been crucified. If life was the highest good, we wouldn't have Christian martyrs. Something else might be more important for us than our own very life if we are ready to give our lives for Christ. And if you take these two basic principles, life is sacred, I cannot take anybody's life, including my own. But life is not the highest good, which means especially in the situation where we can spend a great deal of money, a great deal of resources in order to protect and preserve preserve a particular, a single life, we need to ask ourselves how long and how much do we ought to invest in prolongation of life when life as such is not the ultimate good. And so different people might make different decisions around this, and that's the part of deliberation. But I think these two principles, in my judgment, they stay firm. Once we affirm these two principles, then the interesting discussion can begin. I think it would lead us to the point where we will say, we will not spend inordinate amounts of life to keep somebody alive, but we will do nothing in order to terminate somebody's life.
Which is completely dependent on my worldview, which believes that this life is not, that this physical life and that this portion of time is not all that there is. That not only did I have a personal beginning, but that there is a personal God to whom I am going beyond this life. So I think that the worldview conversation for the average person, they may hear what you're saying and absolutely 100% agree, and then realize that their neighbor doesn't agree and would go to absolutely any length to preserve this physical life. And that's because their neighbor doesn't know the reality, that there's any reality beyond this, right? Is completely, their reality is completely confined to the senses, to what the sensory experience.
Or the other side of it is, as we see in a number of European states, but also in some states in the U.S., we think sometimes that our lives are in our hands, and therefore that we can have physician-assisted assisted suicide, so that I decide when my life should end. And to me, life to me is a gift from God. And as a gift from God, I will have it until this gift has been taken back to God. God is the Lord of life.
Well, Miroslav Volf, I'm so glad that your life is one that God has given, and I'm so glad that you have given that life back to him in a way that is equipping the rest of us to think faithfully and seriously about the issues that we confront in our world, and to equip us to be better able to deliberate well, not only in the privacy of our own deliberations where we wrestle with things, but in our deliberations with one another in this pluralistic culture in which we live. So you are equipping us well, and I appreciate that. I would love to continue this conversation with you in the future, because I have this whole litany of conversations that I would love to have, not least of which is, how do we as people of faith in a culture of wonderful religious freedom, how do we learn how to live well when we're being told by our culture that there are now new civil rights that are somehow superior to our constitutionally protected right of religious freedom? And I know that's a whole nother conversation, but I look forward to having it with you at some point in the future.
Let's do it. I'd be glad.
Okay. Great. Miroslav, thank you so much for being with us today on the Reconnect.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, friends, if you liked what you heard today, Miroslav is actually going to be back with us next Wednesday. We're going to be talking with him about issues related to privacy and religious liberty. On the religious liberty front, one of the stories that I missed last week, and I don't want you to miss, was actually from Tom Jelton at NPR. You can pick this story up at npr.org. It's entitled, In Religious Freedom Debate, Two American Values Clash. Now, you and I have talked about this subject matter before, that we have this value of the freedom of religion on the one hand, and yet we have this new effort. I'll say new because it's, you know, maybe only a little more than a decade old. This showdown with those who are advocating for their sexual liberty or issues related to what they would describe as freedom from discrimination related to gender identity and sexual practice. So at the debate's heart, and Tom Jelton lifts this up, we're talking about what it means to exercise one's religious freedom. And so we're going to talk about the First Amendment. These are all things that we'll talk with Miroslav about when he is back with us next Wednesday. But this NPR article by Tom Jelton is a good warm-up for that conversation. And I think that when the rubber meets the road on these issues, one of the things that we need to continue to remind ourselves is that the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause is just that. It's about the free exercise of religion in every area of life. You will see continual effort to reduce that to the private freedom of worship or freedom to worship, that would be an activity that would happen inside the context of a sacred worship space like a church, and it would happen at a designated time out of view of everyone else. And so I'll point you here to the resource that we have or the conversation that we had with John Anuzu, law professor at Washington University in St. Louis, whose book Confident Pluralism actually lays out a really good approach to this conversation. And those are some of the questions that we will raise to Miroslav when he's back with us a week from today. Hey, in the second half of the program today, I'm going to be joined by Paul Batura from Focus on the Family. We're going to be talking about adoption, and we're going to be talking about famous adoptees. It's a really it's a fun conversation, and we consider the fact that each and every one of us as Christians are adopted as heirs of the kingdom of heaven. We are adopted into the family of faith through Jesus Christ. Adoption is a conversation that we need to be having in part because there are so many kids in the world who need a forever home, and you and I have the opportunity to answer the needs of a lot of the world's children, but it's also an identity issue for us as Christians. Tomorrow, I'm going to be broadcasting live from the WAVA studio in D.C., and we're going to be having some very political conversations with folks like Michael Ware and others. So I invite you to come back and listen to that show as well. Hey, let me remind you that we have a resource posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Folks, a lot of people are seeing the movie The Shack. And I recognize all of the theological issues, and I address those in this resource. But I also recognize that when people go to a movie, they're not really having an intellectual, theological discourse. What they are having is an emotional experience, and they're responding to images on the screen, and they are being provoked to feel something. Well, a lot of folks are going to find their way to their own shack, that place where in pain and in suffering they got stuck, and from which God very much wants to draw them forward into a redemptive relationship with himself through Jesus Christ. And in order for that to positively happen, Christians actually have to be prepared to engage people who see The Shack in meaningful conversation about what they experienced in the movie. Where did that take you? Where is your shack? Where are you stuck? Would you like the kind of transforming encounter with God that Mac had? All right, friends, we're going to have to leave it right there. Visit me at reconnectwithcarmen.com and stay with me through the break. I'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Reconnect with your host, Carmen LaBerge. Now, back to Carmen.
Hey, friends, I'm Carmen LaBerge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We invite you to connect with us online. Our website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge, hashtag Carmen Talk. We've been talking a lot about pro-life issues. We talk a lot about pro-life issues, and we certainly talk a lot on this show about foster care and adoption. And so we continue that conversation today with Paul Butera. Paul is the Vice President of Communications for Focus on the Family. He is a speaker and author. His books include Good Day, The Paul Harvey Story, which we all would immediately want to know what's the rest of that story. And then his latest book is called Chosen for Greatness, How Adoption Changes the World. So Paul and his wife, Julie, are proud parents of three young boys, all of whom they have had the privilege of adopting into their family. And you can check out what Paul is thinking about, what he's writing about at his website, which is paulbatura.com. And his last name is spelled B-A-T-U-R-A. Hey, Paul, welcome to The Reconnect.
Oh, thanks, Carmen. It's great to be with you.
So, Chosen for Greatness, How Adoption Changes the World. Tell us the motivation for writing this book. Is it curiosity, self-discovery? What's going on here?
Well, I love biography. You know, you mentioned a few that I've done, and being an adoptive dad, I thought when we're talking to our kids about adoption, we try to make sure that they understand what it means and know that they were adopted as early as they can, even really before they even understand what adoption means. I'm always looking for good stories to try and instill in them the fact that adoption does not put you at a disadvantage. In fact, I think history will show you that adoption has been the reason so many of very well-known people were able to do what they did. You know, the new homes that they were brought into, the families that they were surrounded by, the opportunities they were given. So when I went out to just sort of research who's been adopted, I thought, isn't this interesting? When you look at, these are household names, people we all know. And it was just kind of fun to put it down on paper to be able to talk with them about it. And it kind of just turned into the book.
Yeah, so you say there's household names in here. I'll rattle off a few so folks will know some of the adoptees whose stories you chronicle in Chosen for Greatness. Steve Jobs, Nancy Reagan, Nelson Mandela, Babe Ruth, John Hancock, Dave Thomas, Ark Linkletter, Gerald Ford. The list is pretty long. Newt Gingrich, Faith Hill, Jesus. Right. I mean, you have quite a list of folks whose stories you're telling here. So I don't know. Pick a couple of them and tell us the backstory of the folks whose stories you tell in Chosen for Greatness.
Sure. Well, what's so interesting is that all those names that you just mentioned, when you look up their stories, you tend to just they tend to just treat their adoption as a footnote. You know, the idea that, well, yeah, that's how they came into the family, when in fact it was very instrumental. I'll start with someone who you mentioned, but I'll give you her name before she was adopted. Her name was Ann Robbins. And Ann came from, born in New York, moved to Maryland, wound up relocating eventually with her stepfather in Chicago. And his name was Loyal Davis. She was known as Ann. Nancy was her nickname. She wound up being adopted by Loyal, took his name, eventually went out to California to become an actress. There was another Nancy Davis out in California on the communist sympathizer list. So they said, well, you need to go talk to the president of the Screen Actors Guild to straighten this out. Well, of course, the rest of the story, as you referenced earlier, that was Nancy Reagan. She wound up meeting her husband there, and it really wouldn't have happened had she not been adopted, had she not changed her name, had she not, of course, been adopted. And most people say that had Nancy not met Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan wouldn't have become governor or president. So it's, you know, we believe in the sovereignty of God, the idea that all things happen for a reason, and God is going out ahead of us, and he's positioning things and putting people in our place and in our path, and that's just, I think, a fascinating one of the many stories in the book.
Well, and I think that that idea that sometimes we consider adoption a footnote in someone's story, when none of us as Christians would say that about ourselves. Like, our adoption into God's family through Jesus Christ, that's not a footnote to who we are. I mean, that's core to our identity. And so I think when we begin thinking about it that way, it helps us understand how it could be certainly core and central to the identity of an individual who not only, you know, thanks be to God, did their mother choose to have them, but then they're chosen again by a family that intentionally chooses to bring them into, you know, enfold them into their own family and certainly raise them as their very own. So I'm curious, why did you choose these people? There are obviously millions and millions of people whose stories you could have told. Why these?
You know, I chose them, Carmen, primarily because I, you know, knew them in the sense that I know them from history, and I thought other people would as well. And then, of course, just trying to find the more intriguing ones, the ones that kind of just scratch your head, like the Nancy Reagan story. And, you know, Gerald Ford, another one you mentioned. Here's a guy who was born in Omaha, Nebraska, whose mother, I had never heard this before, and I studied history and political science. His birth mother scooped him up in blankets, had to escape from their home because his birth father was threatening to kill both mother and child with a butcher's knife, ran across into Iowa, was rescued by her parents, and then wound up a couple of years later meeting Gerald Ford Sr. And as Gerald Ford Jr. would later say, you know, my adoptive father was the antithesis of my biological father. He was calm, cool. He was obviously loving, caring. He taught him all those attributes that he needed to succeed in life. And I had never heard that. I had knew, of course, Gerald Ford, and maybe I knew he was adopted, but I didn't know the origin of the beginning of his life. I thought it was a fun kind of a book to put together for that reason alone.
Hey, friends, if you're just tuning in, we are talking with Paul Batura, the Vice President of Communications for Focus on the Family. He's the author of Chosen for Greatness. You can find Paul and information about the book online at paulbatura.com. That's BATURA.com. So, Paul, how does adoption, by your own now research and by your experience as an adoptive dad, how does adoption change the life of the person who adopts another person?
Well, in profound ways, of course. If you haven't been a parent, of course, it makes you a parent in some ways overnight. But I think it, for me, I can speak very personally here, it has humbled me in ways that I never imagined. The first way is that, you know, when you apply to be an adoptive parent, you have to go through quite the rigorous evaluation. You know, that's not the same evaluation that occurs when you have biological children, of course. That can be humbling in the sense that, you know, you have people who are investigating your life, looking into your background, trying to make sure you are a responsible person, worthy of taking on this responsibility. At times, you know, it can be a little intrusive, but then you realize, well, wait a second, this is the greatest honor you could have. If you can look anywhere in my life you want, you can look at my bank account, you can talk to my friends and family and neighbors, it's okay. If it means getting to raise these kids, this is worth it. So in many ways, I've been humbled through that process. And then just the whole idea that a birth mom would entrust her child to me, to my wife, that's kind of overwhelming. I just because I know now, having been on both sides of it, you know, adoption to me before adopting was a happy story. It was always the scene from the perspective of the adoptive parent. But when you adopt and have open adoption like we have, you see the pain and the sacrifice that these birth moms make. These are courageous women who say, I want to give my child what I cannot give them. And in our case, they thought, I want to give them a dad because I can't be both a mom and a dad. I think that's a common thread in a lot of these infant adoptions that you see. These are sacrificial decisions, and it's not, you can't take it lightly. And when you watch your child's birth mother cry tears on the, literally fall from her onto her child, it's really humbling, and what a privilege to get to be an adoptive parent.
Mm. So I will admit that I am, you know, I am a person who loves to read about and take in stories of adoption, because I think that it is so honestly reflective of the experience that we have as Christians. And so I think that they are stories that need to be, they need to be trumpeted. And I recently read about this couple in Las Vegas whose neighbor had three kids. They have five kids of their own, biological kids. And their neighbor, literally, she's a single mom who's alone in the world, right? She doesn't have, she had grown up in the foster system, and so she doesn't have a family, like a family of origin, as we might think of it. And so when she found herself terminally ill with cancer, she didn't have anybody to turn to in terms of an extended family that would take her kids. And so she turned to these neighbors. And their story is just so extraordinary in terms of the answer to the question, why are you doing this? Because they now have these eight kids, because they're the biological mom of these three has now passed. But the question that this young woman, this young mom who has five of her own and now a total of eight that she's raising, you know, her answer was, well, they're kids. I took them because they're kids. I'm doing this, you know, because they're kids. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people just lose sight of how much need there is in the world for adults to be adults and be responsible about that and provide for kids. So can you just talk about the need that you're aware of in the world for kids to have adults who recognize the need of children to be adopted?
Oh, Carmen, it's so profound. That's a really moving story. And, you know, we talk so often or we hear so often in news about, you know, the investments you make in your 401k or your 403b and mutual funds and all of this. The best investment you can make is in the life of another person. And in this case, in the life of children. There are over 400,000 kids today in foster care. 100,000 of those 400,000 are available for adoption today, like right now. If you feel your heart being moved to consider adopting, these children would love to be welcomed into your home. Not everybody has that call. Not everybody is in a place to do it. But for those who believe the cultural lie that I can't afford it, it's too expensive, it's not too expensive, there are ways to do it. There are ways that people who want to help you, governments want to help you make this happen. It's really, you know, if you could change the life of a child, is there anything better to spend your time on? Really? I can't think of it. I mean, it's, you know, you never regret. You always hear from parents who maybe had one child, oh, I wish I had more. This is your chance. If that's really what you feel, then I really encourage people to prayerfully consider it. And if there's other ways to support, of course, you know, you have respite care and you know, temporary, you could support another family that's walking that road. But boy, in a broken and challenging world, there are so many children out there who just want, you know, we get calls from families here, and we hear these really heartbreaking stories of, you know, 18-year-olds who time out of the system. They just, you know, mm-hmm. they haven't been adopted. And where do they go at Christmas when they're on mm-hmm. college break? And they just need a family. They would love to have a family. Maybe you want to adopt a 17-year-old girl. That's a possibility, too. The opportunities are out there, and the need is great.
Well, and it's such a demonstration of the gospel to our lost neighbors if we are to do something radical like that for another human being. So can you just speak to that, how this is all? I mean, I know that the motivation to adopt is not to demonstrate the gospel, but demonstrating the gospel is a byproduct of adoption. Can you speak to that?
Oh, it sure is. You know, that's why I left and kind of concluded the book with Jesus, because I think most of us don't necessarily think of Jesus as an adopted child. He was. Joseph was an adoptive father. You know, when you adopt and when you become a Christian, let me start there, Jesus and, of course, God has adopted you into the family. There's nothing you've done to earn your place in eternity. It's by God's grace alone. The same goes true with adoption. You know, these children have not done anything to qualify. They simply have a need. You adopt them. They inherit all the rights that come with being your son or daughter. And it is a great witness to the world. Adoptive families, I think one of the most beautiful things now is the multicultural adoptions that we see, because I think that's a great witness. Children don't necessarily blend in. We have two Hispanic children. And we get looks all the time. We get questions all the time. Are these really your kids? You know, and you can have a little fun with, you know, should you say what this, you know, the whole thing with what's proper to say to a family is a whole other conversation. But it really gives us an opportunity to talk about what we're doing and how excited we are to get to do what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul Batura is the Vice President of Communications for Focus on the Family. He's the author of Chosen for Greatness, How Adoption Changes the World. And I think that we would be quick to say, Paul, that adoption changes the world because adoption, you know, changes the life of a child. And none of us can anticipate what that's going to mean, who that little person is going to ultimately become. As you present to us this list of people who have achieved great things in the world and whose names we largely recognize, you know, we want to be quick to say also that there are millions of other stories, success stories, of people who, because they were adopted, it changed their sense of themselves, and it provided for them opportunities to live into the fullness of their identity and be, you know, ultimately who God created them to be. So thank you so much for writing the book. Thank you for joining us today on The Reconnect, and thank you for being an adoptive dad.
Oh, thank you, Carmen. It's really kind of you to talk about this topic because it never gets old. There's always need.
All right, it's time for us to slip below the fold and see what is happening out there. I decided that since the rest of the show was so heavy today, that I just wanted to bring you just a flat-out good news story.
So our below the fold today actually comes from the wedding announcement section of my local paper in the town where I am spending this week writing. So I opened the paper to a beautiful wedding announcement. The joyful bride-to-be and her groom were beaming. Their wedding is to be held in the largest church in the county, and they're inviting any and all to attend. Their reception will be a traditional church fellowship hall carry-in, and there will be cake and lemonade provided for everyone. The wedding will be at 11 a.m., the lunch at noon, and everyone is expected to be gone by 1 o'clock. That seems like a lot of information for a wedding announcement, but included was a paragraph about their engagement. It's an engagement that spanned decades. They were separated first by war and then by a series of circumstances. They are now each nearly 90. Engagement and betrothal, worthy of consideration in our casual culture, where impermanence seems to reign, even in the area of our relationships. This is a couple who committed themselves to one another 70 years ago, and they are now finally being wed. That's a long engagement. So what is engagement? What does it mean to be engaged or betrothed, to be married, to be wed? What is the relevance and significance of marriage or weddings in our culture today, or even in the world at large? Does marriage even matter anymore? Well, this would be one of the places where I feel like Christians really have an opportunity to declare the truth and goodness not only of God's design, but of God's redemptive plan. It is God who gives us marriage for the full expression of love between a man and a woman. It is God who gives us marriage for the flourishing of human society, for the birth and the nurture of children. And it is God who gives us marriage as a way for us to catch a glimpse and enjoy a foretaste of the mysterious intimacy of Christ and his church. That's actually the way the Apostle Paul describes it in the book of Ephesians. It's a mystery. And those of you who are married, you have a little bit of a taste and a hint of what that means. Indeed, two become one. That's a mystery. Indeed, the concerns of the other become more important than the concern for self. That's a mystery. This is a bond of union where two become one to the glory of a third, to the glory of the Father. That's a mystery. Human marriage is a parable of the eternal truth of God's redemptive relationship with human beings. It's an earthly image of God's divine plan. It's a touch point between the eternal and the everyday. And yes, it is mysterious, even in the midst of being very mundane, right? Because life in marriage comes with a rhythm that happens in and out of every day and in and out of every life circumstance. And it comes with a rhythm that can become routine if we allow it to. But then there's this mystery in which I love this other more than I love myself. This mystery in which I have a greater concern for the other than I have for myself. This mystery in which I want to be with this other person, really to the exclusion of others. But then together, we are something that neither one of us is alone. And together we are something mysterious, a little bit odd to the watching world. Well, here's why that's true. It's because marriage is given by God to reflect a pattern of Christ and his bride, the church. human marriage is not the original design. I think that we get it backwards when we think that marriage is something that God points to in human reality to help us maybe to help us. That's really not what's going on. God gives us marriage in order that he can help us see and understand eternal reality and his ultimate redemptive plan. Human marriage, again, is not the original design. It's a copy of the original design. I think we get that thinking backwards. We think that the Bible talks about the church as Christ's bride because it's an image that we'll understand from our own experience. Quite the contrary. God gives us human marriage as a reflection of the divine reality. The Bible talks about the church as Christ's bride because that's the reality of eternity. So, why get married? Why does God, through Jesus Christ, even want to have this kind of intimate relationship with human beings? Isn't God satisfied with himself? Yes, absolutely. And yet, we as individuals are quite satisfied with ourselves, and yet we want to get married. We don't want to be alone. Why not? Because we're actually designed in the image of God. After the image of God, we're designed for relationship, and not just any relationship, but a relationship with him. So why get married? Mutual affection, genuine self-sacrificing love, the desire for one another in a shared life, the desire for children, the desire to not be alone until death do us part. Well, yes, all of those, but mainly this, sanctification. Sanctification. I want you to envision a triangle. Envision a triangle where the bride and the groom are those two separate points at the base of the triangle, and God is the third point at the top. As each of those two individuals grow more intimate with God, they quite naturally move toward one another. The reverse, you will recognize, is also true. As we move individually away from God and our intimacy with God is lessened, we also move naturally further and further apart from one another. Obviously, marriage is an experience in which we get a foretaste, a glimpse of Christ's relationship with the church, all of which is designed to be to the glory of the Father, to the glory of God. And so, as you and I grow individually in our sanctification, as we are conformed by one degree of glory to another, by the work of the Holy Spirit within us, as we are more closely drawn to God through Christ by the power of the Spirit, we are in our marriages naturally drawn closer to one another. If you reverse this and you think that through a human relationship, through strengthening the ties that bind here on earth, you will somehow achieve some kind of spiritual union, you're wrong. Try as you might, that's never going to work. Solomon actually talks about that in the book of Ecclesiastes. And so if you want a little lesson about how human relationships, no matter how diverse and no matter how many you might try, will never lead you to the kind of intimacy with another person nor with God that you really desire, just take a reread of the book of Ecclesiastes and all the mess we can get ourselves in as human beings. All right, so here's the challenge. Sin confuses the metaphor. The metaphor of marriage, of a man and a woman brought together into a mysterious relationship that reflects the nature of the relationship of Christ with his church is confused by sin. Now, in our culture, this is like so apparent to us. We see this all around us all the time. This is why we end up with broken marriages. This is why we end up with broken families. This is why we end up with broken people. And yes, this is why we end up with sexual confusion. And this is why we end up with all manner of redefined, quote unquote, marriage, most of which has no resemblance whatsoever to God's design for marriage, which is intended to reflect the relationship of Christ and the church. Here's the challenge that I believe we have as Christians in our culture today. We need to redeem marriage. We need to redeem marriage for kids of divorce. We need to redeem marriage for a culture that's confused about the identity of the self and the role of genders. And even the reality of God and the goodness of his character and his plan. We need to redeem marriage so that the Redeemer can be known. Let me ask this question. Is marriage held in honor among us all? That's the biblical mandate.
So are you fiercely defending your own marriage? If we're engaged with the culture on the subject of marriage, with the goal of illuminating the eternal reality of God's goodness and intimate affection for all, then in our redemption, marriage likewise gets redeemed.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.